Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the Museum of Modern Art. This is the second of three conversations in our fall series, Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. Next week, on November 6th, Doug Aiken and Olafur Eliasson will join us for the spectacle of contemporary art. Echoing the museum's general educational mission to foreground the voices and ideas of contemporary artists, the Artists Speak series aims to engage artists in discussion about their work and the most significant issues in contemporary art and culture. In tonight's conversations, Artists Among Nations, Gada Amer and Alfredo Yar, will discuss the role of contemporary culture and the artist in an international nomad, that is, the notion of the artist in the world at large, and the work that they create both within and outside of the nations that they grew up in. I'm thrilled that Gada and Alfredo, whose achievements cannot possibly be reflected in the brief introduction I want to make, have joined us tonight because they are two artists that I admire enormously. As is usual with this series, each will make a short presentation of their work, and afterwards, the three of us will start a conversation and then open it up to all of you to ask whatever questions you may. Gada Amer was born in Cairo. She studied the École des Beaux-Arts in Nice, the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and the Institut des Hautes Études en Arts Plastiques in Paris. Her work has been presented in numerous solo and group exhibitions at venues such as Deitch Projects, the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, the 2000 Whitney Biennial, Greater New York 2000 at PS1, and the 1999 and 2000 Venice Biennials, among others. She's also served as a juror on the Aachen Award for Architecture, which is where I got to know another side of her character. Alfredo Yar was born in Santiago, Chile, where he studied architecture and film direction before moving to New York in the early 1980s. He has participated in the Venice, Sao Paulo, Johannesburg, Sydney, Istanbul, and Gwangju biennials, as well as Document and Kassel. He received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1985 and was a recipient in 2000 of a MacArthur Award. I'm especially pleased that he also has a work on view as we speak at PS1. It's entitled Introduction to a Distant World, and if you haven't seen it, I urge you to do so. Thank you, Gada and Alfredo, for being with us. Gada?
I love the computer, you know? I'm old-fashioned. I'm going to show slides. Can you hear me? No. Okay. Hello? Yes. Hi. I brought with me some slides. I'm given 15 minutes to make a presentation. So with the very bad slides, I'm sorry, only just maybe one part. My later work is a little bit better since I got a better gallery. So I'm sorry. I will explain to you. So the way I like to present my work is I made it into categories, but it doesn't mean that it's not a chronological order. I'm going to explain to you like briefly how I got to do the work I do, which I'm mostly famous for, which are my paintings and my drawings. And then, so I put it paintings, then drawings. I'm showing some collaborative work I do with Reza Farkondi, who is here tonight. I'm going to show some of my sculpture and some of my garden project, which is not very... I don't know if anybody ever even seen it. So it's just an excerpt of each category. So we can start the slides. Okay. So I am born in Cairo in 1963. I left with my parents in 1974 to go to France because they had to study. So I was 11 years, and then I left in the 70s. And then during the 80s, I went back for the first time since 74, and all the 80s, something very. For me, very weird was happening. I was witnessing more and more each time I was going, 80, 81, 82, more and more veiled women. Sorry. And in 1988, I discovered this magazine called Venus, which, you know, it's very weird for me to explain this right now because it's very difficult to get as a Muslim artist to speak about this because we are witnessing a little bit in the West the same thing. But so each year it was more and more conservative until I discovered this magazine. We can go to the next slide. Which is called Venus, a special edition for veiled woman, and it was, as you see, a cut up of faces and long clothing, and where they were putting the veil. And we can go to the next slide. This thing, I was never used to see it in Egypt, and I just bought this magazine. I was in. With my mom in downtown, and I don't know why I was very, very attracted to this magazine, and it was sold with a pattern how to make these clothes. We can go to the next slide. So, it's still very scary for me. This magazine is like maybe, so. I tried to do a lot of. I worked with it for a long, long time, from 1988 until 91, until I really tried to understand why I was attracted to this magazine. Because at this time, I was witnessing this going very conservative, but I didn't know what was going on in the world. The problem is now we understand, but at this time it was like I just was feeling something was going wrong, but I could not. Spell it out, or I could not. It's weird. I hope you understand. In the same time in France, I had a teacher who would refuse in France in Nice in 19. This was in I did my studies in the end of 1980s. Who would refuse to teach painting to women? This was the situation. So I was very upset because I went to school to study painting and. So I had this magazine, and I didn't want to use it and I didn't want to do anything with the woman wearing veils because I didn't want to have anybody pointing me out saying, oh, she's working on Muslim women, poor Muslim women, they are like this and like that. And in the West, we don't know as well the woman had problems. So I didn't want to represent Muslim women. I didn't want to represent. So I was very, at this time, confused. I wanted to find a way to do something that would speak to all women. Anyway, I was so frustrated and I wanted to paint. My focus was I wanted to paint with a tool, to find a way to paint with a tool that belongs to women. We can go to the next slide. Oh, I think I can. I was supposed to do it. Sorry. All right. So what I did in the beginning, like after I worked with this magazine, I painted this woman, I cut out all the, like it was, then I decided to drop all of this and just use the needle and the thread to represent women in their daily life routine, such like getting bored. These are the bad slides. Everybody sees that this is the woman, the femme qui zappe, the woman who watched television. And my work is not at all, it may seem conceptual sometimes, but it's not a conceptual work. So it's while making it that things happen for me. I have to make work so that it it evolve. So I did all this painting with all of them, with women, like blonde women or Western women, bored, lovers, and things like that. But I was like, this is not paint. I wanted to paint. And I was telling myself, no, but with the embroidery, I needed to find an image that would be contrast with the embroidery itself. So in 1993, I got the idea of using a pornographic magazine and using women from this realm, which was a men's realm, and repeating them on the canvas so that I could fill out the canvas like a paint. And then I started to leave the thread. I have a very specific technique, which has evolved as well. But this thread that is left over was my drip of paint. So I started to be a little bit more happy about the product like this. And for the first years, I didn't want to paint at all the canvas. In the beginning, until 93, I painted on the canvas, and then I stopped painting. But then it was as well boring for me, so I started painting again on the canvas and embroidering. And for me, yeah, this is as well. I did some. This is the recipe of the Black Forest cake, and the definition of love according to the dictionary. At the same time, I started using text very early in my work. It's not everything is parallel, as I said. So then I reintroduced painting, and especially expressionist painting, as male element, or if you want. But if you want, it's easier to put it that way. I did two shows in the States in 96 and 97, and then in 2000 I did this show where I introduced the painting in a Dutch project. And at the same time, I came here in New York with Reza, who is a friend of mine I met in school in 1988, and he got very, very sick with depression, and he was at my studio, and at the time he helped me. I would tell him what helped me so that he gets out of depression. He didn't want to paint because he thought that his painting was the paint or art is the cause of his depression. Then he started to paint, and then he painted on my canvas, and then I would tell him, do this blue, do this black, and he would do it. And then one day I come back, and all of what I said to him, he didn't do it. He just painted whatever he wanted on my canvas. And I was like, what did you do? And then I was like, but it was very beautiful. And I was like, oh, my God, he's crazy. He became crazy. Not only he's depressed, but then there was, very he became crazy. So I really was like, okay, what am I going to do with this? And then it was beautiful. I was like, what is this? And then I said, okay, I'm going to use it. And then I embroidered over it, and then he would let me leave, and then he would paint over what I did. And then we started to have this conversation. So this was starting in 2000. And then slowly, like, I had this body of work that I had this painting that he wouldn't even touch, and other part that he would touch, and then those ones got me to other idea of painting, and then I was telling him, I have, like, you have to sign with me. And then he's like, no, I'm not signing with you, it's not my work, it's just this is not art anyway, and I'm just having fun. And then I said, okay, but I have to. So what I did is I in the title of all of this body of work, I titled them RFGA, and until now, we are doing this. We have now in, like, new games of doing RFGA. So now he become better, and he's doing his own art and stuff like this. And then so this is how this body of work, which is very weird and of a collaborative nature, started. And even we still don't know yet how to situate them. But this is, I guess, art. Like, you do things and then you think about them later. And then we decided actually a year ago that we are going to collaborate properly. Like, so all of these are the RFGAs start with the paint with a big flower. Yeah, so since one year, we decided to really collaborate on, we started to do it on prints, because we said, oh, we don't care on prints. If we are going to make a new adventure, if it's not good, we don't care. because nobody wants it anyway. So we started to make drawings, to make prints, and it with our really both work and with signing them together. Even in the beginning, I signed Gada Amer, RFGA, if you can see here, but we are re-signing them together because we didn't know, shall we sign them one name or the other name? But then now it's really, these are part of another, a new series of work that are done really on, like he's not sick, he's like, so we are signing them together, and it's very different because it takes elements of his work and elements of my work. No, what did I do? Oh, it's the other one, sorry. A nice one. Ah. So these are and they're going to be exhibited at the Studio Museum of Harlem in April, and it's very brand new experience that we are doing. We are just like, we did 10, and then we are like, no, 20. We saw them at the Stedelijk right now, and then it's coming here for, and we are continuing, and we are developing this series of work. Okay. I'm on time. It's okay. All right. I can continue. So this is the part of my sculpture. I started sculpture as well. Very sculpture, drawing, and painting. I don't know what I did. I started sculpture, painting, and drawing in the same time, very early, like 91. I have another body of work that is my garden, which I started only in 97. Later. So, this is an early piece called the "Conseil de beauté pour le mois d'août," beauty tips for the month of August, where you know, you read in Elle magazine how to take care of your body in August because it's in August you show all your body, so you have to take care of it. So I just embroidered it on four handkerchiefs like this. Oh no, what did I do? Like this. This is a detail. C'est vos jambes, your legs. And this is a straight jacket for Barbie and for Ken. On top of Barbie, it's written, Barbie loves Ken, Barbie loves Ken, like a punishment. And on top of Ken, Ken loves Barbie. This is private rooms. And this is a piece I did because I wanted to read the Quran and take only the excerpts that would speak about women. And I embroidered them on those parts of this is and this is the burqa. It was I did it in 95, and it was getting so bad, the veiling, that I decided to do my own burqa in case I was forced to wear it. So I did it in out of this sexy clothing, and it looks like a bra or something. And here I worked with a lace maker, a French lace maker, one of the very best ones. And it's the definition of the word fear in Arabic, here on the mouth and on the mouth and on the nose. Where you see those two things is to put your eyes, not your breath. It's like a video of pleasure. This is it's about censorship, and it's I found this manuscript of the Middle Ages where it was a man who wrote an encyclopedia of pleasure, and he says, in the name of God, I'm going to teach you how to be a better Muslim, and in order to be a better Muslim, you have to be a better human being, and in order to be a better human being, you have to be a better sexual being. And he did like this huge book about it's an encyclopedia, so it quotes earlier work and poetry that speaks about sexuality. And I was very interested because spirituality and sexuality never goes together, especially in the Muslim world where we are supposed to be so prude. And so I was, and of course this encyclopedia, it's forbidden. We cannot find it. It's my sister who are doing this. Actually, it's my sister who told me about this book because she was writing on that. She's a researcher. So I wanted to embroider it as if to save it from disappearing. This is my drawing, my garden projects. I'm going to show three of them. And this is Love Park. And I, from this abundant area, I put those benches, 10 benches, and I sliced them into two halves. And each half is looking at other direction. And there is a quote. I don't quote the author, but I it's a quote from my readings. And they speak about love and life in a contradictory way. So you come with your lover, you never sit next to him, just always back to back, and you read contradictory quotations. So this is, I am going to give you some of the quotation that I, because I found it interesting not to quote who, is it a man who said this, is it a woman, is it So it was going on and on like this. This is a piece I did before the war in Iraq, and it's it was in Miami, and I did a peace sign, big peace sign, with carnivorous plants. And I made a cocktail party where I invited people. I was serving worms, live worms and crickets. And I so that people go and feed the plants. This is another piece I did in Wellesley College, and it was in the cafeteria of the museum or in the school. Before the museum, it's very weird. There's a cafeteria where the student can come, and there's a museum, and this is like a cafeteria of the school. And what I did is, this piece I did 2 years ago. Oh, yeah. It's the definition of the, I'm sick of hearing terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. So I decided to say, what does it mean, terrorism? Suddenly it was just like, it means nothing. So I decided to go back to look at the dictionary and make research of this word. So I made research as far as I could go in, actually it's like, and I discovered that it's a word that it's from the Reign of Terror, that is from the French Revolution of Robespierre, where they were killing people to be democrat. I was like, what? And then it evolved this definition, and so I decided to write it on this wallpaper. So from far you see this wallpaper, and when you come close, you can read all of the definition. And I said, I'm going to do the same thing in Arabic because they had two walls like this. So I said, like one in Arabic and one. And then I made the research in Arabic and I couldn't find a definition. Or I found one definition, which was a translation of a definition, a Western definition. And it came very, very late. It was in the 70s. So I was quite surprised by this myself and very shocked. So I did this piece where I put on the mugs of the people, like everything that the people were eating, this quotation. They were eating terrorism for a week. That's it. Okay, I did it.
Good evening. I'm honored to be here. For the last 20 years, I've divided my work in three main areas. one-third of my time is spent working within what we call the art world. But because it's such an insular world, another third of my time is spent working in what I call public interventions, works that take place in communities far removed from what we call the art world. And then another third of my time is spent working in schools and universities in a dialogue with the new generations. These three activities keep me complete. Without them, I would feel that I'm not a complete artist. My better-known work is the one that takes place in the art world, and I will share with you a couple of those, but I will also share with you some of my recent public interventions. I'm going to start with a segment of a film that is my most recent project. It's called Mushima. I've been collecting African music for the last 20 years, and the focus of my collection is music of Portuguese influence, meaning music coming from Angola, Mozambique, and Cabo Verde. It's a music that touches me personally, that moves me. When you combine music from Portugal, the former colonial master, what we call the fado, and you combine this with the African sounds, the result is very, very moving, and it moves me deeply. So I've been collecting this type of music. A few years ago, I was organizing my my music from Angola, and I realized, just by chance, that I had six versions of the same song called Mushima. So I put them in chronological order, and I started listening to them for a couple of years. And I realized that the earliest version was from 1956, and the oldest one, the most recent one, was from 1998. And by just listening different interpretations of this song, you could hear the history of Angola. So I thought this is a nice device to use for a film. I went to Angola, and I did a film based on this song called Mushima, which means heart in Kimbundu, one of the languages of Angola. I discovered that Mushima is also a church, which is placed 300 kilometers south of Luanda. And Mushima is also a popular song. In this film, I divided it in 10 cantos. And it lasts 30 minutes. I will share with you just a single canto. Each canto is structured like a short Japanese poem, like a haiku, because I wanted to suggest, to evoke, instead of actually showing. I didn't want to repeat any of the insulting images we see in the media about Africa. So it's really an evocation, a poem, a visual poem. So I will share with you canto number 9, which deals with three issues. The issue of AIDS, which affects between 12 and 15% of the population of Angola, mostly women. The issue of oil. Angola is the second largest producer of oil in Africa today after Nigeria. 10% of the oil of this country is coming from Angola. And in spite of this vast wealth, that money is not being invested in Angola right now for health services or social services. So 80% of the population is very poor, and there are really no health services for people suffering from AIDS. So in this canto number 9, I work with three issues. The third one is the power of the church and how people look for the church as a refuge. And so I will share with you this canto number 9 from my last film, and then I'll show you other works.
Thank you. kambe wanga wanga ungibeke wa santana si wanga mbe wanga wanga ungibeke wa santana watolila jimujibie watolila jimujibie watolila jimujibie mama wa sibila dikasoka watolila jimujibie watolila jimujibie watolila jimujibie mama wa sibila dikasoka Mushima, 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 Ayue Mushima. Mushima, Mushima, Mushima.
In the film, you hear Mushima 10 times. And a very simple idea is that the audience will leave the theater or the art gallery knowing the song by heart. And they can't get it out of their heads or their minds or their hearts. So this was Canto 9 of 10. I'm going to move now to a few public interventions. This is a town in Sweden called Skoghall. This is City Hall, and this is the church. This is one of the main pedestrian streets, and this is how people live today. When the city was created 30 years ago, this was a house for 8 families. Today it's a single family house. So there has been an incredible progress in the last 30 years. This is a company town that was created 30 years ago by a paper mill, the largest paper mill in the world, called Stora Enso. So Stora Enso decided to install them, their headquarters here, their world headquarters, and they became the largest employer in the area. So they brought in 3,000 people to work for them. They basically had to create the habitat for the workers, then a church, then a hospital, then a school, and a town was born. Stora Enso creates a paper called Tetra Pak, which is the paper that we use for milk and juice cartons. It comes out in a very large format here. I was invited by the town of Skugal to do a public intervention. And normally I go 2, 3, 4, 5 times in a couple of years to visit the place, to understand the place. And I discovered very quickly that Stora Enso had financed the entire town. But one thing was missing, a museum or a space for exhibitions, a space for culture. So I rejected the money, the funds being offered to me by the city, and I went to talk to the board of directors of Stora Enso. And I said, listen, it would be much more coherent if you pay for the first cultural institution. They accepted my challenge and then financed the project. And the mayor saved a lot of money. So here's the inside the headquarters. And we designed and built the first paper museum for Skugal. It measures 6 meters high, 8 meters by 20 meters long, and it's entirely made out of paper and wood from the paper mill. The ceiling is paper, the floor is paper, and because we could not use electrical power, I created the design in such a way that we had a lot of natural light coming from the right there and from the entrance. And for the first show, we invited a group of 16 young artists from around Sweden to create special works for this show, dealing and focusing on paper. This is a preview before the real opening. For example, an artist from Stockholm created this table where she offers paper origami style for children to create paper sculptures, of course, in reference to this town where paper is king. Another artist did a survey on the phone asking people, to 65 people, how is it possible that for 30 years you never had a museum, a cultural space? Most people would say, oh, we're very happy with this. We don't need one. So this is the opening. The entire town showed up. And we had music played by the Paper Mill Orchestra because, as I said, they own everything. And Mr. Leif Bergman, the mayor of Skugal, opened officially the museum. And like in most openings, we can't see anything. This is the table with the origami. And this is a few hours later. Exactly 24 hours after the opening, we took down the Swedish flag, and this is what we did. The burning was pre-planned. Everyone knew that this was going to happen. The idea was to offer the community a glimpse of what contemporary art can do, and once they had it, to take it away. And because I felt that as an artist from Chile who lives in New York, I was not going to impose a cultural institution on a community that doesn't want one. So I just wanted to give them a glimpse. So that's what we did. A few hours before the burning, a group of concerned citizens formed the Friends of the Kunsthalle of Skogad, and they came to see me. They said, "Mr. Jarl, congratulations. We understand the project. Let's keep it." I said, "It's too late. I've even worked with the fire department in order for this to burn and to collapse inwards and not outwards for security reasons. And the first rain, the first snow will destroy it, so we cannot save anything." They accepted my argument. But 2 hours later, another group of ecologists showed up. They said, "Why don't we save the wood for a playground?" And I said, "Well, listen, you have a paper mill here using all this wood for 30 years. Why do you want my wood? Go and get your wood." They boycotted the burning, and they got inside the museum, and they didn't let me burn it. So I had to come to a compromise with them. I offered them to design a playground for free if they let me burn my museum. They accepted. I dedicated this project to Monica Johansson, a local artist who has nowhere to show. This is Helsinki in Finland. As you walk around Helsinki, you discover very quickly it's an incredibly homogeneous society. And you discover also that unlike Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, that have welcomed 1 million immigrants in the last 10 years, Finland had welcomed 17. It's a very restrictive immigration policy based on the fact that they have been conquered by the Russians and the Swedish for 600 years. So the year I was invited to do this project by the Museum of Contemporary Art, Finland was applying to become a member of the European community. And I felt there was a contradiction between closing your doors to immigrants, to the outside world, and becoming also part of a larger community like Europe. So I created a project called 1 Million Finnish Passports. After 6 months of fighting with the immigration authorities, I was authorized to print 1 million passports. And the condition was to put them behind high security glass and to burn them after the exhibition without cameras recording that act. Why 1 million? I had calculated that in most European countries, approximately 20% of the population are foreigners or people of foreign descent. So this million represents the million foreigners that Finland should have by now. And the project wanted to ask, do we want to remain insular, or do we want to welcome new faces, new colors, new ideas? The lighting of the piece was such a way that people could see themselves reflected through the glass, and through their own image, they would see the passports. We made the front page of all the papers and magazines and the TV. But the most moving reaction was a citizen that came, saw the show, went back to his home, and came back with his own passport and threw it on top of the pile as a sign of solidarity. 1 million Finnish passports in Helsinki. This is a museum being built in Caracas, Venezuela, in the poorest area of the city called Catia. The community was not consulted. They didn't want a museum. They would have preferred a sports complex, which they don't have. The museum is being built in this park, which is famous because of this prison, the most dangerous prison in Latin America. But the government said, "No, we will build you a museum on the same park, actually." You know, artists, criminals, the same thing. So this is Katia. So I went many times to Katia, and I realized I was being rejected because they simply didn't want a museum. So I felt that the museum was going to be built, was going to be exist. It was better for the community to use it for their own purpose. So I created a project called Camera Lucida, where we distributed 1,000 cameras, disposable cameras, around for the community and invited them to photograph Katia. And that when they came back to pick up their prints, to select a print that would be shown here in the museum. So when I said this project to the director, she said, forget it. They're going to sell the cameras in the streets. That's not going to work. I thought, I'm going to give away 1,000 cameras. Even if only 5% come back, I can print the images very, very large, and I have a show. But 747 came back. So I had the problem in reverse. How do you show 747 images? I brought you a selection. This is Rosa Murillo. So it was a big community event. Everyone became an artist. The show lasted 6 months. The idea was to conquer the space of the museum, to make it ours. Albaniz Carrasquez, Osvaldo Yáñez, Victor Herrera, Jimmy Vergara, Romy Moncada. So people started using this as a tool to show the visitors what the city, the way the city is treating the area of Catia. Victor Herrera, Douglas Yerkes, Ronald Rosada, José Rivas, Franca Capobianco, Douglas Muñoz, Domingo González, Victor Herrera, y Alejandro Chiftate. Cámara Lúcida in Catia, Caracas. I have two more projects. This is Montreal in Canada. As you move down from downtown towards the south, you arrive at the Cathedral of Montreal, which divides the old part from the new part. The old Montreal is this. It's a place with boutiques, cafes, and bars, and a lot of pedestrian areas. I was invited by the city to do a project in this building called the Cupola. The Cupola remains empty since it burned 5 times. It was a siege of the Canadian Parliament that after the 5th burning, they left for another building and left this empty. And the city doesn't know what to do with the Cupola. On my 5th trip to Montreal, I was walking back to the Cupola, and I realized that there was a truck delivering food to this building without any sign and any description. And I realized by going to the door that this was a shelter for homeless people, a place where they give food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner to 1,800 people every month, no questions asked. I was told that there was another shelter a few blocks away, and a third one a few blocks away. I was shocked to discover that Montreal has 15,000 homeless, one of the richest countries of this continent, one of the coldest winters of this continent. So I started discussing with the homeless people. I did many lectures in the shelters, trying to understand their predicament. And I learned 2 things. First, that they do not want to be represented. The most beautiful image, the most beautiful picture would not make it. They just don't want to be displayed in any way. That was a marvelous lesson. The second lesson is that they feel invisible, that when they're asking for money in the street, they really want to be recognized as human beings. It's a sign of their humanity. And so I decided to work with these two dilemmas. And this is what we did with their approval. Inside the Cupola, we installed 100,000 watts of red lights that, when activated, the Cupola becomes red for just a fraction of a second. And we connected this to a device inside the 3 shelters. I'm going to go inside the shelters without showing you anyone inside. So here, I'd like you to see the poster on the right side that explains the project and simply invites homeless people coming in to push that button. As you push the button, the red light goes on the Cupola. And so we have a similar sign in the 3 shelters. So the light went red all the time, as a sign of the presence, the increasing presence in the shelters. It was such a scandal in the city. We made the front pages of all the papers that all the other shelters wanted to join us in a network, converting this building into a shame for the city. But the mayor stopped it after 6 weeks. Lights in the city. This is my last, most recent project now that took place in Leipzig. It's also a public intervention. As you know, Leipzig is in the former East Germany. It's a very beautiful city. And the administration is trying to recover the downtown area with gorgeous buildings. They have left a few historic buildings from the pro-Soviet era, like this government building with this Lenin monument outside. This is the Opera House. And this is the Nikolai Church, one of the most famous churches in Germany and in Leipzig. Famous because this is where Bach played when he was young. But it also became more famous because here, in this church, a priest started making sermons and inviting the community to come to listen to him. And it was there were very political sermons, and he attracted large crowds. And a movement was born in this church, a movement that is being giving credit to bringing the wall down, the Berlin Wall down, started here, in this movement, in this church. An artist was invited to commemorate this movement, and he replicated a column from inside the church outside. As you can see, it's an identical column. So for him, this column, free of the weight of the building, the weight of history, symbolizes the new gain, freedom, in the former East Germany. But there is another Leipzig. One third of the city is collapsing because the funds that Germany, West Germany, is bringing in were not enough. And this area of Plagwitz has hundreds of buildings collapsing, being sold for nothing. And they are closed out and occupied by homeless people. And the people in Plagwitz refer to the reunification as annexation and not reunification. I was invited by a group of young artists to create a project in this area to call the attention of the world into Plagwitz and to the predicament of young people growing up in Plagwitz. After my third research trip, I discovered a church located exactly on the limit between the center of Leipzig and this area called Plagwitz. It was for sale for €1. So we purchased it. And we cleaned it because it was about to collapse. We cleaned the benches. I thought, well, since this movement to bring down the wall started in a church, why don't we do another movement in this other church? And we will do something here. And we will create a space for conversation, a space for discussion, to invent a different world. So we cleaned up the benches, we took out all the dust, and we cleaned up the walls. We left them in their state of disrepair. We cleaned up the vitriol, and we got rid of the broken glass. We did what we could to make it a decent place where to meet, where people could meet and talk about their future. And the challenge was to create an event here that would attract people and that would act as a catalyst for a meeting place. This is what we did. Every 10 minutes, this is what happens here. We played Bach all the time, similar to the Nicolai Church, and every 10 minutes the volume increased and the chandelier came down. The logic of the piece was, since that there is no church anymore and this light doesn't have a divine function anymore, why don't we bring the light down and it becomes a kind of fire, a place, a meeting place. So the structure of the space changes dramatically when the light starts coming down. And of course, I was making reference to the other church. The piece was called A Requiem for Leipzig, even though Bach never wrote a requiem, but I wanted a kind of provocation in the title. So this is what happened when people came. It attracted an incredible amount of people, but I completely miscalculated the power of this image coming down, and people remained completely silent. Not a word was uttered in the church. So it served to bring people in, and they started the discussion outside the church. But it didn't happen as I planned that it would happen inside the church. A Requiem for Leipzig. I will stop here. Thank you.
Pose-toi au centre. Thank you very much, Grada and Alfredo. Your work, both of your work, raises so many intriguing questions. I want to start, Grada, with you. You talked a little bit about your painting and that you had developed a technique with thread. Do you want to talk how you go about making your works and who actually makes them?
Make my work is I paint first, then I draw, then I unstretch the canvas. Well, first I stretch the canvas because I don't like to buy the already primed canvas because it doesn't work. I need it to be stretched and unstretched many times, so I like to prepare my own canvas, so I stretch it then first. Then I paint, then I draw, then I unstretch them, then I roll them onto two tubes, and then I... Me and my assistant, more my assistant than me, sew them. So I do them sometimes. When we are in a rush, we have to take turns because it's very intensive work. And then the way it's like embroidered is I leave you know, those drips are not glued after. They are built in the canvas. This is the important part. So I take a piece of thread with a needle and I broaden it, and then I leave another thread. Then, so I have like if it's a reverse, if you sew in the reverse, then I stretch them. Then I put a gel medium, then I sign it.
So they're very labor intensive.
Yeah. I need a lot of people to help me.
Alfredo, your work strikes me, especially some of the projects you showed, as really deeply concerned with the idea of light, your use of light in different instances, sometimes blinding almost. How do you think about light? What does light mean for you?
Well, light is life. And I started very early on using photography. And photography also exists thanks to light. Without light, there is no photography. There are no images. And as you know, also, I never studied art. I studied architecture. I've always said that everything I know about art, I learned studying architecture. And in architecture, light is a very fundamental element. And whatever you do as an architect, you incorporate light as part of your program. So When I approach a project, I give myself a program, and light is one of the fundamental elements of that program.
Gada, your work, especially the work that incorporates pornographic images, is obviously highly charged, by definition almost, by your use of these images. Are they meant to shock us? Are they meant to entice us? How are they to be read?
Well, they're not meant for the public, like for you or for the public. I never work. It's for me. Really, it's like very. It's mainly really to. I grew up in a very conservative environment, and for me, sexuality was not something that taught or like would speak, like would not talk with my parents or something like that. So I had like a lot of problems. So I had, in a way, I think my art or my work is really for myself to just liberate me a little bit. And so I don't even my garden or other work. It's not meant for like my private room, for example, which is. Not at all a sexual piece or erotic. I did it as well for myself because I wanted to read Quran through. I wanted really to know what would say about women, for example. So I made the research myself, the terrorism piece as well. So each piece and each, it's really for myself. And then I don't know if, because I don't know if people would, I don't have anything to impose to people or to
Is it work, clearly by its nature, that's controversial? For sure, for instance, in a Muslim country, it would be very difficult to show your work there.
Yeah, and in a non-Muslim country as well.
Have you ever tried to show any of your paintings?
I showed it in Egypt. Very early on, actually, in 1994. I got even, people wanted to show it in 93. I was shocked. Like, on a private level, it's never not the museum or an institution. This is no. They know my work, but they will never show it. I know that. But in a gallery, I got a gallery who showed my work. I accepted only in 97, but they approached me in 94. So it's very contradictory.
And what happened?
Live, I'm here.
Alfred, a lot of your work deals directly with political issues and your effort to sort of make them manifest. Sometimes, as you showed us with Mushima, really deeply troubling problems. And yet the images you create can be ravishingly beautiful, seductive, and do you worry or think about the relationship between the aesthetics of what you're creating and the issues that you're actually grappling with?
Yeah, when I'm asked this question, I always quote Godard, was one of my heroes. Godard said that it might be true that you have to choose ethics or aesthetics, but it is also true that whichever one you choose, you will always find the other one at the end of the road. And so basically, I think that I've created myself a system where I'm perfectly aware of that. So whatever aesthetic decision I'm taking, I'm also taking an ethical decision, and vice versa. There is nothing we do that doesn't have an ethical dimension and an aesthetical dimension. So basically, I'm not afraid of beauty. I'm not afraid of aesthetics. I think they are part of my program, and they are part of my objective to seduce in order to introduce certain ideas. Because if I'm just dealing with horror, then I wouldn't get anybody close to my work. So basically, the aesthetic part is as fundamental as the ethical part.
There's an aspect, though, of certainly a number of your projects. I think it's the lament of images, some of the Rwanda work, where, in fact, the images are so horrifying that you've almost eliminated them, or you work towards eliminating them. Do you want to talk about the lament of images and in how you ultimately arrived at... this is a remarkable installation that involves several different rooms and asks the viewer, in a sense, to imagine what images might be like rather than to encounter them directly.
Well, I think we live in a very paradoxical situation. We have never been bombarded by so many images that come to us without warning, without mercy. And we have lost the capacity to react to these images. We have lost the capacity to see. And but at the same time, there has never been so much control about images, both from governments and corporations. And so in Lament of the Images, it started when I went to visit Robben Island, which is an island where Mandela spent 27 years of his life as a prisoner with his other prisoners, all political prisoners. And they were taking every morning to a lime quarry to just dig the lime out with very primitive tools. And this lime was used to white out the grounds of the island. They really wanted to break their spirits. It was forced labor. And so I visited this island and this lime quarry. I took some photographs, I took some notes, and I archived this material. And a few years later, I was reading the Times, and there was a story about Bill Gates, who owns, as you know, one of the largest photo agencies in the world called Corbis. And Bill Gates has been buying smaller photo agencies like UPI, Batman, and images from world museums. And so Mr. Gates had found this bunker inside an old lime quarry in Pennsylvania where he was going to bury 100 million of images in order to save them. And then he was going to digitalize them in order to sell them via internet. So when I read about this story, about these images being buried in a lime quarry, I connected that lime quarry with the lime quarry in Robben Island, South Africa. And at the same time, a few weeks later, the invasion and attack on Afghanistan started. And as you know, the State Department purchased all the satellite rights of images above Afghanistan because they wanted to be able to bomb Afghanistan to rocks without any witnesses. So basically, I connected these three stories, and I thought, I would like to do something with this. So in Lament of the Images, you enter space where these three stories are being told with words of light coming from the wall. And after you read these stories, you're invited in the hallway, and you reach a second space where you're blinded by a very large screen of light, just light. And my idea was twofold. First, I wanted to suggest, let there be light. Let's make light on these issues. And at the same time, I wanted to articulate this idea of the blindness of our society.
This issue of blindness, of what we don't see, it seems to me, Gada, appears in your work as well, because one of the strategies you use, especially in the paintings, is this sense of veiling, that you produce these very potent images, and then you make it almost impossible for us to see them. You hide them from us. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about why you do that, and does that relate to the whole issue of the veil within the Islamic world? Is it something that's conscious or subconscious?
It's not conscious. And actually, when I started my work, I never wanted to do to. It never was related to the Muslim world. I repeated it in my presentation, and so it's. I don't function like this. When I do my work, I don't say, okay, I'm a Muslim artist, I work with veil, and it's like I'm going to veil them, and, you know. Maybe it is like this. You know, I don't say, no, it's not like this, but I consciously don't work like this. I don't know why I am veiling them, but I'm just, what I wanted this was to paint. These are drips for me.
But in your painting, obviously, there's a critique as well. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it's not just that that you were not given access to painters, mm-hmm. But you take on issues of gender, mm-hmm. for sure. But you also take on the whole idea of abstract expressionism,
right.
Which was seen to be clearly a very male-dominated mm-hmm. movement, although not exclusively. Mm-hmm. if this is not about some kind of issue of identity, where is the critique centered? What is it that you're trying to get at?
I don't critique one thing, because if you do critique one thing, it's just a message, and you lose the whole beauty. I like what you said about the beauty of paint, like the magic, the dream, the contradiction. My work is about contradiction. It's not about critiquing one thing. It's maybe, oh, it's I'm a woman. No, I'm a man. It's embroidered and it's painting, and it's eroticism or it's pornography. It's bad, and then yet it's like yet it looks beautiful. I always like to play with contradiction. So it's hard for me to. So the critique is not the critique of, because critique for me is some kind of moral thing, like that something is good and something is bad. I think it's, my critique is more, if there is a critique, is more towards towards feminism itself, where it's like we are not liberated yet, or how can we get really liberated, or can we, you know? So this is more of my main, if you want, my main concern.
Alfredo, when you do your projects, do you make a distinction between the art-based, what you call the art-based projects, I suppose we'd call them the gallery-based projects, and the sort of public interventions, or are they all part of a kind of seamless dimension of your practice?
I kind of make a distinction, really. I escape from what we call the art world, and I work with communities in different parts of the world, and they keep me alive and they keep me real. I really need that contact where I'm faced with real life problem, with real communities, and I try to resolve a problem. And so in a way, the program I give myself is what can I do here? How do I resolve this problem? And sometimes these worlds interact and connect with the art world, and sometimes they don't. So some of them end up circulating in the art world and some of them don't.
And do you choose the communities, or is it always by invitation?
I'm very lucky. I received some between 12 and 15 invitations per year, and I just pick one or two.
Before I turn this over to all of you to ask questions, I'm really interested in how you locate yourself. I mean, this is really for both of you. Gada, you were born in Egypt. You went to school in France, in part. Then in the United States, you live here. Alfredo, you grew up in Santiago, and your practice is at least centered here, even if it's expressed elsewhere. How do you locate yourself? Is New York important to your practice? Is it just another city in the world? Is your art inflected or responsive to being in this city? Or are you, in a sense, nomadic, and New York is simply a port of call?
What do you mean by nomadic?
That you could do your practice anywhere, that in effect New York is just a convenient spot.
No, I can't. I cannot do my work in Cairo, for example. I cannot. I produce work in Cairo, because it's, but I cannot do it there, for example. And I left France because it was very difficult to paint. Like really difficult to paint, because they think they have a problem, or they had at this time a problem with painting. They do, I think.
The French Consul General,
exactly,
by the way, is taking notes.
Hi, sir. I found New York, for me, actually the first person I met in New York was Alfredo. You know that?
Yes, there's a connection.
So there's a connection, absolutely. We shared the same studio. I was painting in his studio with Reza when we came here. So for me, I wanted to come to America because I loved, actually, this museum as well. It's not because you are the director, but really it was for me, wow, this is great. I was in school and I visited my sister who was in New York. And for me, I wanted, this was the art place. I came here to be an artist. It was very specific. So in this sense of nomadic, like if this is my home, my artistic home. But in the same time, I need to go back to Cairo to other places, but especially to Egypt, to get upset and to create work. And it's just more for the emotional part.
Alfredo?
In my case, I came to New York because I saw New York as being a microcosmos of the world. It was a city filled with cultures from around the world. I was fascinated by the fact that, for example, the Korean community had 17 newspapers printed in New York a day. I couldn't believe that. And if you look at every single community in New York, they have their own media, their own communities, their own neighborhoods, etc. That was a fascination. So I came here because it was a microcosmos of the world. Then, after the tragedy of September 11, 2001, I felt that New York is becoming more like the rest of the United States. It has lost this unique character that made it so different before. And then along the way, my practice became more and more nomadic, and I've been working almost all over. But New York is my home.
You just opened a very large exhibition of your work in Santiago. What was it like going back?
It was very moving. I had not shown in Chile for 25 years, so we did a very large exhibition with 10 major pieces, and it was some kind of return home, and it was very emotional and very satisfying professionally.
Let me turn to all of you and encourage you to ask questions. This is, yes, please, just speak loudly. Yes.
I'm really interested in this idea of manipulation you mentioned before with your song. And I think I've seen it in other pieces that I've seen it once. We think of manipulation as something negative, often, you know, manipulating people. And I was wondering if you could talk about that aspect of your work a little bit more.
Well, I think manipulation has a negative connotation, the word itself. And when we refer to manipulation, we may be thinking about advertising and propaganda and things like that. What I try to do in my work, I try to articulate an idea as a response to an event, a tragedy, a situation. And in this articulation, of course, you create a mise-en-scène. And this mise-en-scène is like in film, in theater, in literature, you manipulate elements. In that sense, it has a positive connotation. Like, you could see that literature, writing, is manipulation of words. In film, is manipulation of images and sounds, etc., etc. So I think that that's what I do. I try to articulate an idea with different elements as a response always to a specific situation.
Gada, with your work, I mean, there's also the issue of manipulation is clearly an important dimension, certainly of your installations, and I'm thinking of your garden pieces where you very carefully construct complex situations. How do you look at this question of manipulation or structure in your work?
Well, I didn't get the question of the manipulation to start with. Sorry. I don't know, like, I don't think I manipulate, or I don't know. I don't get this manipulation.
When you, for instance, in your garden project mm-hmm. that you showed us, mm-hmm. you clearly mm-hmm. wanted to create a condition
right.
in which certain kinds of opposing activities might take place.
Right.
Are you, when you're doing that, are you thinking about how will a visitor, how will a viewer, how will somebody walking through this garden react? Are you trying to?
Well, not really, because sometimes you get surprises. Like, yes, I think, oh, I'm going to do this, and then they're going to do that, and then, you know, like this, and then, like, a lot of the time, they don't do whatever what you think they will do. For example, for the
lesson number one about the public.
Yes, for example, for the Love Park, I thought the work was going to be the most attacked because they are going to like bomb it, and it was the thing that I speak about, the sexuality, like the man who is blamed by woman like this, but the one that got bombed a lot was American feminism has a man problem. This was like the public did like it has a lot of like focus on this one especially, for example.
And this is what happens when you work in the public space. You lose control. You might design the work to the last detail, but you always lose control, so you never really know what can happen.
Question in the back.
Yes, I was particularly interested, this is a question for you, Alfredo, about the about the public interventions. And I feel like there are more and more artists who are engaging the public sphere in these public projects. And I'm just wondering, when you made, I do remember studying in college the great Felix Gonzalez Torres piece of the rumpled bed sheets that I think was even a MoMA project. It was on billboards all around the city. And I'm just wondering how you made that leap. I know you mentioned you're getting invited now by cities and institutions to do this, but how did you make that leap when you were studying to decide to do public intervention for public projects?
It's interesting because I never made the leap. I started like this. Because I didn't study art, but architecture, I it was a very natural thing. So my first project in Chile was a public intervention. It was a very natural thing because I was thinking like an architect and I wanted to articulate an idea in a public space. And slowly I started going into the world, the art world and the gallery system. But I really started doing public interventions and I kept doing them. It's an area of my work that is not so well known within the art world, but as I said, I really dedicate a third of my time to this.
Other questions? God, I'm a little interested in the collaboration you're developing with Reza. Mm-hmm. Do you plot this out in advance? Does he talk to you about what he's going to do? Do you talk to him about what you're going to do?
Not at all. Sometimes.
I don't want to get into the private dimension
of
this.
No, it's weird because it's something that is... No, it's not plotted out. If it's like a meeting and then we're going to do this. Like for the drawings, he started to paint, and then I would take this, and then it took me like 6 months to really like work on them. And then he never saw them. And he was not even in the beginning, not even interested to come and see them. And then I would give him something, and he would do whatever he wants with it. And sometimes in the paintings we do, but in we are really doing the drawings. It's very new, so we don't know exactly how. It's very new, so we started like this. So I don't know, because we don't have the same studio as well. So he started it at his studio. I take them to my studio, and I work on them.
And then give it back to him?
Sometimes, yes. Like, then he comes and says, oh, it's finished. And then he decides as well, like, we decide together if it's finished or when I'm not happy, he takes it back and then he does what he wants. So it's very, it's not, I don't know how the other artists, like, collaborate. It's not, like, in the same space at the same time and, no. It's always, like, I take it and then I do something and then he...
I'm thinking of that surrealist game of the exquisite cadaver where a piece of paper is folded and...
Yeah, but in the cadaver exquis, they don't see.
That's right.
They don't see. I see. We see, but we don't... The game is not to interfere because if you see him or if I see him intervening on my thing, I was like, no, don't do this. My painting.
Alfredo, I was really struck with the work you did in Sweden, where you obviously got the community activated. The tree huggers, of course, we could identify with here at the Museum of Modern Art. I have to tell everyone a small anecdote. When we renovated the museum, it involved having to remove trees from the garden because obviously we were going to do a lot of work in the garden. The trees had to be taken outside the museum and stored. course, the tree huggers immediately got onto us that the trees couldn't be removed, that if they were removed, they had to go to a nursery, they had to be cared for. I mean, this became a very complicated thing to do, so I could absolutely empathize with the environmentalists. There is a beautiful grove of trees at the New York Botanical Garden, thanks to the Museum of Modern Art. But I actually have a serious question inside all of this, which is, your intervention activated the community. It galvanized them, and then in a certain sense, it frustrated them. Do you continue on with the community after you've done a project? Do you work with them? Do you keep a contact up? What have they done? Did they ultimately build an art center or continue to talk about art?
Well, I'm very proud to report that, first of all, they created an association of the Friends of the Future Skugal Konsthalle. And they requested a site from the city, which was given to them. And now they're trying to get the funds to build a real Kunsthalle. So I try to keep in touch with the communities where I've worked. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes more difficult. But we try to follow up. But it's not easy because I'm working on different projects at the same time and in different places. So, and I've made more than 50 public interventions so far. So it's very complicated. But we try to keep in touch. And in the case of Skugal, I've also started designing the playground for children that I promised to do without any fees in exchange for them allowing me to burn the museum. So sometimes the relationship grows after the initial project.
Hanna, would you talk some more about this? Because I think it is one of the more striking aspects of your work that certainly brought it to a large public attention. And this is the kind of tension you create between feminist values and feminist ideas, and if you want to call it voyeurism and the sex trade. And you may be doing this all for yourself as an experiment. I want to really get at, you know, how do you think these paintings are received?
But ask them.
I want to know what you expect from your viewers.
What do I expect? I expect them to find them beautiful. It's important for me.
So beauty is an intrinsic...
Yes, very, very much. It's very important that it's beautiful. I don't know. I don't work like this. I don't work like, okay, what are you going to think about my work? I don't work. I can't. It's impossible for me. I want them, people to buy them.
So the market
to hang them on their wall. No, I don't really. It's very difficult for me to answer to this question because I always never liked any artwork that pretends to teach to the public something. For me, it's something very painful. I don't believe in that. So when I'm in my studio, I really don't think about the public.
You obviously have a very different relationship with the public, Alfredo.
Absolutely. I try to be a great communicator. I believe that art is communication. Communication requires a language, and a language requires a vocabulary. And if there is a gap between the art world and the rest of the world, it's because this vocabulary is difficult to understand. So when I'm facing a project, I give myself a program. And within that program, the audience that I'm working with is a specific audience. And I'm trying to have a dialogue with that audience. And so the entire program is directed towards creating an interaction with that audience. And the success of the piece will be how much I manage to dialogue with that audience. Because one thing that is important about communication, and we tend to forget that communication is not only to throw a message out there. That's not communication. Communication exists only when there is an answer. No answer, no communication. So communication is a fundamental aspect of my work, and it's part of my program.
I want to say something.
Yes, please.
Okay. For me, for example, there's no answer to my question. There's no answer. So maybe That's why, maybe that's why I don't.
There's no answer for you to
for
you?
For me, for feminism, for what is going on the world, it's so contradictory that I don't find there is an answer.
I search an answer, and sometimes the answer is silence, sometimes the answer is very active involvement in issue. I want to inform, I want to move, I want to share information, I want to share pain, I want to communicate different ideas. I really want to do that.
Yeah, I understand. It's just your definition of the if there is no answer, there is no communication. I don't totally agree with that, but it's okay.
Keep going.
No, but I said it. There is my work. I think is based on the thing that there is no answer. There is no specific answer. There is no. It's not a yes or a no or a solution.
So you propose to us something we can look at. And impose on it whatever meanings we want.
No, not whatever. Yes, no, whatever meaning like this. No, but but like maybe it is. Maybe I am like I don't take position in a way, or it's always. But this is what I like. It's really it's a strategy in a way that.
That's what we're trying to get at. Is
yeah,
your
I know, but I. But I don't think this way in the studio. I'm not. Because my work is not like Alfredo's, where it is the public, and at least my painting works in the garden. It's a little, it's like it's very different. But the painters, I don't know. But you are inside the studio by yourself, or it, you know, and then you have to create something in your. Yeah, I don't know. It's you have no surprises because you know that the paint. Except if you change the brand of your paint or something like this. This is the surprises you get. But so it's a different kind of relationship to the public by its nature.
Okay. Question. Yes, please.
I want to ask Alfredo about what reminded me on this work you did in Sweden. And as you said that you love
not really.
Sweden.
Yes. No, I know that film. Tarkovsky is one of my favorite filmmakers. But no, I've always wanted to burn a museum.
So, we are really happy you chose to do it in Sweden.
So this was the perfect way to do it. And you see, when you create a work, you are stimulated by many ideas. And I think we are an answer to all the stimuli we receive. And here, the single idea was really to create a need to a community that felt didn't have a need. So I was looking for a strategy to articulate that idea. And so that's how I came about this idea, to give it and then to take it away in a very spectacular way.
Yes, please.
It's for Gada. I guess at the beginning, I think you said, I believe you said your work is not conceptual. Yet, the first time I saw one of your paintings, I couldn't help but put my face right up against the sexual being that was on the canvas, which was a very conceptual experience for me. Kind of what I brought to the table was pretty important in that experience. Is there, while it's not your objective, do you think people bring their experiences to the paintings?
Yes, they do.
Maybe that's not the strategy, it's the effect.
I don't know why you keep on asking me what the people think of. I don't know. I would like to ask the people. Maybe you know. I don't know because I make the painting and it's difficult for me to make them and look at like think. It's difficult. It's not. I don't think this way. I don't know. It's just very difficult.
I want to push a little bit in a slightly different direction.
Right.
But, I'm not going to give up. You know
no,
me too
I
well.
Know.
In the piece that you did, I think you showed it at Deitch Project, mm-hmm. which used the Encyclopedia of
right.
Pleasure, in which some very explicit mm-hmm. descriptions of pleasuring men and women are produced. That could have been embroidered rather beautifully here in New York.
Right.
But it wasn't.
No.
It was embroidered in
Cairo.
So clearly that was a decision on your part to ask a group of women, I assume.
Men.
Group of men.
Well, I'll tell you what the story was. The story was, it was not a decision because it was so expensive to do it here, so I decided to do it in Egypt. And in Egypt, it's fine if I do text. It's not a problem. First, they don't understand English, so it was fine. Then I said it's going to be easy for me. I had this just pleasure, to take this text that was forbidden, to bring it back to Egypt in my suitcase, and just like in English, but in a version that nobody will not even like, and then make people embroider it. This was for me very, but I did not do it on purpose. I never do anything on purpose, you know. So I went there and I contacted a woman actually that knew somebody to embroider. And it's a very technical. It was very, very hard work. So she had to put it in a semi factory, and it was men who were doing it, and I just found it and she wouldn't let me go and talk to them for some reason. So
she knew you.
So she was telling me who would embroider and what, and then at the end they didn't understand what they were embroidering, but at the end they started to ask her question. So what are we embroidering? So, but it speaks about and they started, I think, to really understand what they were doing, because it took 6 months to do it. It took a long, long period of time because it's. So it was very. So this was the story of the encyclopedia.
But whether it was intentional or not, it absolutely raises issues of censorship, reception.
Absolutely, yes.
So in effect, get back to strategy.
Right.
Clearly you were after some kind of either overt or implied statement about the ways in which certain kinds of knowledge, certain kinds of texts can be, even if they were originated in one place,
right,
can only be understood in other places.
Yes, absolutely. It's all about the translation, because as well, I choose carefully which language I use in which text. For example, Private Rooms, it was not done in Arabic. It was done in French. So it's very important, the translation, where, how knowledge travels and who reads them. And I'm very sensitive to it because maybe I have been traveling all my life. Maybe I speak a lot of language. So for me, it's the language part of the text is very important.
So communication is important.
But it's not strategy. I just enjoy it. I don't know.
We'll take one more question, if there is one. If not, I want to thank Laura Bayless and David Little for once again making this evening possible, and thank all of you for joining us.